Hello and welcome to episode 9 of Zero to Agile. I am your host, Phil Japixi. This episode of Zero to Agile is brought to you by Telerik Team Pulse, project management software based on Agile best principles. You can find more information about Team Pulse at telerik.com/teampulse. That's telerik.com/teampulse. I hope you enjoy the show. As you may or may not know, every month we do a free Q&A panel via webinar where we discuss various Agile topics. And our August topic was Agile Myths. And it turned out to be a great show, and I've taken the best of the questions and answers and placed them into this podcast for your listening enjoyment. If you would like to sign up for a future webinar, you can go to bit.ly, that's bit.ly/teampulsewebinars, all one word, all lowercase, teampulsewebinars, Team Pulse Webinars. Now on to the show.
Sure, why don't we just start with some introductions first while we do this. My name is Joel Semenyuk. I'm the Executive Vice President at Telerik. I'm in charge of the Agile Project Management Division. And been doing Agile much before it was even called Agile. I've been working in the industry for close to 20 years, and close to around the 1997-98 time frame, we were developing our own kind of sets of methodologies, which were influenced by our learnings and what we felt were some things that needed to change in the industry, and started actually doing a lot of things that we didn't call Agile back then, but we're very Agile today. Around the 2001 mark, when Agile became ratified, it was kind of like a revelation to us that we were doing a lot of these best practices already. And this is a very common story for a lot of people who have been in this industry for a long time, is that, you know, many of us have been doing Agile-like practices for a very long time. So over the past 10 or 11 years, I've been doing a lot of work with the Agile and Lean community now. I've been doing lots of work with Lean and applying Lean manufacturing principles to the world of Agile software development. And, of course, running a division here at Telerik.
My name is Steve Porter. Thank you very much for that introduction, yourself, Joel. I'm currently the product owner for Team Pulse, and before I was brought into that role, I spent many years doing basic consulting, software consulting, and then kind of moved into my specialty being agile consulting, so helping companies make that really difficult transition to classic waterfall to agile software development. So I do have a good understanding of our topic today, because often when I'm brought into an organization to, you know, help us become agile, they already have an idea in their head of what that means, and sometimes it's correct and oftentimes it's not. So looking forward to hearing people's questions. They might be going through the same transition that I've seen other companies go through, and I hope they'll be able to help them out.
My name is Rhett Romero. I'm the guy on the left there. I'm the Agile Process Consultant here at Telerik, and I'm the one that usually you will be speaking with if you're on the East Coast of the U.S. and having conversations around best practices, how our solutions from training and consulting all the way out through our actual applications that we offer can provide value and benefit and obviously help your teams succeed with Agile.
So I'm Phil Japixi. I'm the guy on the right, and I'm the Agile Practices Evangelist for Telerik. I run the Zero to Agile podcast and create other content and things like that. I also speak a lot in the community on various topics, including Agile, of course, but also Agile software engineering, such as TDD and BDD. And I'm happy to be here. And one of the things that you'll receive for attending is a copy of my ebook that I was the main writer, but I'd be remiss if I didn't give Joel, Steve, and a host of other people credit for doing some editing and contribution for me. So it's definitely a team effort, and I think you'll be happy to receive it. I always start my talks on Agile by discussing the Agile Manifesto, and one of the great things about the Manifesto is its brevity. And, you know, they start off by stating the problem, right? We are uncovering better ways of developing software by doing it and helping others to do it. And they came up with these four values. And if you're not familiar with the Agile Manifesto, we'll talk about it briefly. If you are, it's always great to have a refresher on it. But they talk about individuals and interactions over processes and tools, working software over comprehensive documentation, customer collaboration over contract negotiation. And lastly, responding to changeover following a plan. And those are sort of the main points that they wanted to address. But I feel that the most important part of the entire manifesto is the last sentence. And if you read that, I think this helps dispel a lot of the Agile myths. They say, while there's value in the items on the right, we value the items on the left more. And so I look at that and I say, nowhere in there does the manifesto say you can't have a process and you can't have a tool. Nowhere does it say we're not going to write documentation or not have contracts or follow a plan. It says we value those things and use them where they're needed and at the last responsible moment and things like that. If you're doing consulting or any sort of work, you need to have a contract in place. Otherwise, you're just donating your time to charity. If you are working, especially in an enterprise, you've got to have a plan. We have a plan, right? We have release plans. Sometimes we make them public, sometimes we don't. But we have a plan, but we also respond to change. That plan can change. And that's the beauty of the Agile Manifesto, is that it doesn't say stop doing all these things that we know work. Keep doing the things that you know work, but let's focus on these things that will make it work better.
There was a question from the audience that asked about why is there so much pushback against estimating stories with time. Thought I might open up with that one, because I think that is a bit of an Agile myth, that Agile projects don't care about time, don't care about deadlines, don't care about, you know, having to deliver something by a certain date, that it's just, as Joel up with, just a whole bunch of surfers out there doing whatever they want, delivering when they want, and in the real world, in the business world, we have deadlines, we have timelines, and we have to make those. So I think that's a myth. I think that in Agile projects, you do have that time is important, deadlines are important, and tracking time is important. And I think one of the reasons that you may get pushback on estimating in time, because that's really what the question was, like, why is there so much pushback? Like, everybody wants to estimate in stories. Why stories? Why not hours? And I've worked with Agile teams that have estimated in stories. The Team Pulse team, actually, when I first started the project, when I was brought on board as a product owner, estimated items in, I think it was days, right? They weren't using points. And that was working okay for them. And I had suggested to switching over to stories. And the reason I did that, the reason I think that you get some pushback on estimating in hours, is that sometimes it's easy to misunderstand what those hours mean. That those hours equate to, I am going to have this activity done by taking today's time when I gave you that estimate in hours, adding on that many hours, and that's when that particular item is going to be done. So if I estimate an hour, a story at 14 hours, that might be difficult for some people to understand. When is that going to be done? Because as soon as you have hours attached to something, people equate that with that's the time when the item is going to be completed. So 14 hours, well, if you're starting that today, that means you're going to have it done today, because a day has 24 hours in it, right? We know that's not right, that you only have an 8-hour working day. But is that even right? Do you really get 8 hours in a working day? Maybe you only get 6 or 6.5 hours. I find that estimating in time takes a little bit more effort to get people to understand what that time value means. Again, not that we don't value having things completed by certain dates, but you just need to be really careful when you're estimating in time that everybody has a clear understanding of exactly what you're estimating. And when you're estimating something in 8 hours, that doesn't mean that it's going to be done 8 hours from now. The important thing is when you're estimating is time to understand that that estimate really should be used just as a relative measure between other stories. So if this story is measured as 8 hours, then it's half as large as a story that we might estimate in 16 hours. Now, and again, here you can see where the difficult in time is. That story that I estimated 16 hours, I might actually, even if I start both tasks or both stories at the same time, I might actually get the 16-hour story done first because I'm able to work continuously on that story for multiple times, where that 8-hour story, I get interrupted, I'm not able to complete it. It may, as far as duration goes, take longer to complete, but the effort is still half the size, or should be half the size. So I hope that at least gives you my impression of why you might get pushback estimating hours, and I hope that also might address that myth that agile projects don't care about time. Joel, you want to add to that?
Yeah. So when I look at why we promote using points versus hours, is because it gives us a bit of a better model for actually doing measurement versus estimation. I'm a big, big fan of measurement versus guessing. So let me kind of approach it from a few different angles. Angle number one: the more granular the decomposition, the more error you're going to introduce into the aggregate of that decomposition. So when I look at my decomposition, I can, if I break it down into many, many, many small little things, I actually can't just add them up together and expect to not have a lot of error introduced into it. I actually have to, in order to properly aggregate the decomposition, I have to actually do some fancy statistics in order for us to it to be very, very accurate. The other aspect is when I estimate in stories, I'm taking away cost, I'm taking away time, I'm taking away those variables and forcing us to look at it slightly differently and a way that we can measure it in terms of our team velocity. So here's an example. So if my team is able to do in 2 weeks 30 story points worth of work, these are abstract numbers. I can actually turn those into dollars, right? Because if my team has an hourly rate, I can turn my 2 week schedule into 40 hours a week per person, and I can derive a cost for that 30 story points. So I can associate the story points, but I actually don't have to do the level of decomposition up front and introduce a lot of errors in the aggregation of that decomposition. What I'm actually doing is measuring the way that we the way that our team produces. There's also another interesting psychological component when it comes to estimation. Human beings are very, very good at sizing things, two things with one another. So I can tell you if one thing is bigger than another, even if it's a very abstract concept. But we have a really hard time putting quantity and qualifications around that. So what we end up doing is we're able to say that this one is bigger than, this feature or story is bigger than that one by a magnitude of two. We're very good at doing that. We're very good at finding an anchor, which represents something that we're going to compare to, and very good at making those comparisons. We are not very good at decomposition at all, and furthermore, the aggregation of that is very, very complex. So if we're leveraging the human mind, the way that it works, a little bit more naturally by allowing it to compare two things with one another and assigning orders of magnitudes to those things, if one is three, if something is twice as big, it's a six. And then second of all, measuring the amount of story points my team can actually deliver helps me have a better understanding of a true measurement and a much truer predictor in terms of what my team can actually achieve with the list of things that I have to build. So instead of lots and lots of guessing and magical Excel spreadsheets that are used to aggregate all of your estimates together, which will typically be wrong anyway, you actually have a model that leverages the human mind as well as being able to measure accurately the capacity and velocity of your team without having to do a huge amount of decomposition.
And the follow-up question is, what point would you say you convert stories or points to time? At some point you need to know when it'll be done, when you have a deadline. The way that I recommend when I'm coaching teams, and especially working with training for Team Pulse and other agile topics, as Joel and Steve talked about, using points for stories is awesome. And what we recommend is that when you take those stories and distill them down into the tasks, that at the task level, you start assigning time. For example, the PERT estimation process is very beneficial. It takes the optimistic and the pessimistic and the realistic estimates you put in there and uses some fancy formula to come up with what it will probably take to do this task. And that satisfies a lot of the, we'll say, PMO folks, right? Because you know, a lot of the Agile books talk about, well, you know what, we're just going to have, you know, 7 to 10 developers sitting in a room, holding hands, singing Kumbaya while they're wearing their Birkenstocks, and we'll just write code until somebody tells us to go away, right? Which, again, you know, follows into the, you don't have a plan, there's no architecture, things like that. But at the end of the day, you've got to come up with something that tells your customer, as Joel talked about and Steve talked about, that says what you're going to deliver when, you know, at least some sort of idea. So if we can take our story points, when we make tasks for those, put times around them, and the way I recommend, and this is certainly can start another long debate, the way I always recommended for teams is that no task is more than one day's effort. And PMI recommends that one day be no more than 6.5 hours, right? Because in an 8-hour day, studies have shown, at least these particular studies, that you get about 6.5 hours productive time out of an 8-hour day. And the reason that I recommend that is if estimates aren't right, they're not exactimates. And the only true measure of how long something will take is to do it and then look at how long it took. And by then it's too late, right? Because you've already written it. So if we keep our estimates short and concise. First of all, it's a very high level granularity, so we don't have a lot of abstract assumptions or risks in the estimate. And second of all, if we completely screw up the estimate, which we tend to do, and even I do, right? You know, we all do. Estimation is an art, much more than a science. But if I've completely messed it up, I only lose a day, and I don't blow the sprint or the iteration. If I estimate something as a week and I've completely messed it up and it takes 2 weeks to done, I have probably just torpedoed the iteration and there's no way I can recover from that. So I recommend that you turn things into time when you get to tasks. Keep those time estimates very, very short and concise, and you'll get a wide range of opinions of whether it should be 1 day or 2 days or 3 days. I think pretty much everybody agrees that it should be short. The definition of short changes. That's what I recommend. Is it a myth that Agile fixes everything? And that's certainly a myth. My answer is going to be fairly short. And what I've always told people is Agile fixes nothing. What Agile does, it's not a silver bullet, it's a silver flashlight. So it'll shine a light on all of your processes and all of your people and everything that's doing. And once you see something, once you can measure it, once you can address what's going on, then you can take the steps to fix it. In a traditional, we'll call it traditional waterfall cycle of 6, 8, 9, 12 months, a lot of things stay hidden. We all know that developer who we don't want to give work to because he or she just messes things up and breaks the build. So they spend all this time doing solitaire or playing Doom or something like that, right? And we shield him because, oh my gosh, if we give Bob any work, he's just going to torpedo us. With Agile, that stuff, those people can't stay hidden. Processes and wasteful things that you might do, you know, tons of upfront documentation that turns out being worthless. All those things get exposed, and once they're exposed, you can fix them. So that's my opinion on whether or not Agile is the Holy Grail. I don't think it is, but it certainly enlightens the path to the Holy Grail, and there is no one way to do Agile. You need to do what works for you. The problem is figuring out what works for you sometimes can be a long journey.
Just really quickly to add to that, I've always echoed Phil's comments around Agile not fixing anything. It just shows you really, really clearly what you need to fix in your organization so that you can become better. Really, really like that silver flashlight comment. That's great. I'm going to start using that one. The thing I would like to add is that in my experience, and I think some of the metrics that are coming out of places like Gartner and some of the other organizations that track this sort of thing, is that the method that we were using beforehand, waterfall, often is not successful. For organizations that are using a waterfall, which is big design up front, which is sticking with the plan, that sort of project management mindset is certainly successful in some cases, but in most software development cases where change is an expected quantity, it's going to be happening, that you need to find some other process for that. So maybe it's Scrum, maybe it's not, maybe it's some sort of lean Kanban piece, maybe it's XP, but maybe it is some agile piece, or maybe it is something else, but just sticking with waterfall for software development, because it's what we've always done, we're just going to end up with the same horrible failure rates we've had right from the very beginning.
The only thing I would add to this is quite simply, no matter what flavor you choose, what's important is that you have some sort of continuing improvement process built in so you can reflect and retrospect. And that's a lot of teams don't do. They think, like Phil said, that it fixes problems and it's going to take care of everything. But that's not necessarily the truth. In any team that I've ever been part of, and including the team that I manage now, the success has always been in not so much what the approach we have, because we can adapt our approach and adapt our process, but it's being able to actually capture when things didn't go as planned or didn't go well. But when they did go well, and see what we can do to improve on that. So no matter what you choose, I would highly recommend implementing some sort of continuous improvement process. We call them retrospectives, but you might call them something different.
To help you get a better understanding of the principles and values of the Agile Manifesto, I have prepared for you an ebook called Top 30 Agile Myths Busted. Follow @TeamPulse, that's @team_pulse on Twitter, and within 24 hours, you'll receive the download link as a direct message.
Should stories of features received before or after initial product implementation be handled differently? Basically, the statement is that my company feels that stories received after version 1 are all scope changes.
The whole term scope change really comes down from that stair-step waterfall approach, right? So we have somebody, it's a telephone game. Somebody comes up with an idea, passes it on to somebody who writes it up, passes it on to somebody who writes it up in a technical manner, passes on to somebody who writes it up in a developer manner, and then, five or six people down the line, somebody gets a requirement, writes the code, and anything that's changed from that document that doesn't really match the original anyway because of context, considered scope change. In Agile, we have a backlog, and it is a list of things that could be done. And I don't like to call them requirements. I like to call the product backlog the requestiments, because there's no guarantee that any of them will get done. The only guarantee, and Steve and I have a little bit of a wording disagreement on this, but I like to say that the only thing that's guaranteed to get done is what we accept into the sprint backlog. The new term is that we're going to forecast that we'll get it done, and we can certainly talk about that. So to say that you've got scope change infers that you have fixed scope. If you have fixed scope, we all know the Iron Triangle of project management. If not, there's scope, there's schedule, and there's cost. And you can't fix all three. It's impossible. You can fix two of them, and there are some better combinations of what you fix. And what we like to fix is schedule and cost, because if you give me a date, I can meet it, and I'll tell you how much it costs, because we tend not to work overtime or do death marches in Agile. So I'll take the amount of time remaining in the schedule times the number of developers times whatever their billing rate is. There's the cost. Scope is going to vary. And that's where it gets really important to make sure that the backlog is correctly ordered as well as prioritized. And it can change any time. When we turned the corner into 2012, that the plan for R5 was probably very different than what the plan is now. Is that scope change? Nope, that's adapting to change. And it should be treated as such.
So this is Joel. Let me take maybe a different spin on that. Many organizations want to know how much a thing is going to cost before they'll invest in it. So let's take the concept of a new house. I want a new house. I want to build a new house. How much is that going to cost me? We can't just say, I don't know, let's just start building and see what we come up with. That's not really acceptable. So a lot of organizations look at things from a portfolio perspective. I'm willing to invest $400,000 into that project because that's the value that I get from it is worth that. So a lot of organizations select projects based on the concept of time and money. being fixed. Now, how do they get to that time and money initially? Well, they might do a little bit of an analysis. Well, what will $400,000 get me? It's kind of like a house. If I want to live in a new house and I really only have $400,000 to live in a new house, what will that get me these days? Will it get me, you know, a single bungalow in Vancouver, or will it give me a mansion in Winnipeg, right? So we have to do a little bit of initial estimation. We have to do a little bit of an initial backlog. We want four bedrooms, two bathrooms, two stories, a garage, a backyard, a deck, a sunroom, all that kind of good stuff. And what's really great about that is that it forms our initial backlog. Now, when I start building my house, I start going, huh, you know, I really wanted to have a bigger bathroom. You know, so how do we deal with that? How do we change that, right? The reality is that Agile allows us to, or embraces the fact, as Phil presented, that we can change our mind. We do need to have an initial assumption around capacity, because capacity keeps us focused. And by the way, I'm all for having fixed duration and fixed bid projects, because it gives us a much more laser focus on the value that we're delivering. So now I can say, you know, I want an extra bathroom in my house. The contractor goes, well, if you're not willing to increase your price, are you willing to forego your garage, or go from a three-car garage to a two-car garage? And you go, you know what, I'm willing to go to a two-car garage because I want the extra bathroom and I really don't want to go up in my budget. And then we realize, huh, you know, I want these extra fancy tiles on my floor. And if we're not willing to go up in our budget, the contractor goes back to says, well, you know, are you willing to sacrifice your sunroom? Because right now, the way the budget stands, you can have either the sunroom or the extra tile, but not both in order to hit your constraint. What does the contractor care about it? He doesn't really care about it at all in reality. He wants to make me happy. So I make the decision as a customer, no, I could put the sunroom on at any time. I'll do that later. I'll do it when it's in maintenance, right? One of the things that I like to say is that, you know what, we do have to acknowledge that there is a capacity that we have to deal with, and we might have to do a little bit of work to try to guess what that first release is going to look like. But the beauty about Agile is it allows us to add things to our backlog and prioritize them as we go, and then force those discussions to happen. If, for example, the customer says, no, I want the extra tile and I still want the sunroom, well, now we have to have something a bit more formal. We have to have a discussion about what other part of the triangle needs to change. In this case, it's probably time and money. And so this is where something like a change request can come in. In fact, I've seen Agile projects still actually use change requests, because when you reset expectations according to change, you might need to document those. And even though you might not cost anything or have an extended schedule, even the act of resetting expectations to shareholders who may not be involved on a day-to-day basis in the project requires a little bit of extra documentation. But we do this on exception, not on an everyday occurrence. So you might want to look at that a little differently in addition to what Phil was saying. Steve?
Yeah, I just want to add to that. I think the key to making that scenario that Joel talked about work is really good communication with the customer end. And I think it starts right at the very beginning. So to use his analogy for the house, you know, when you're having that initial conversation with your customer and they basically said, you know, I've got $4,000 to spend on a house. Here's my expectations for what that $400,000 is going to get me. The contractor on the other end, if they're not sure that they can deliver all those items, a good professional contractor will say, you know, I'm not sure I can deliver all of those for you. And it's unprofessional to guarantee that I'm going to be able to deliver the value that you expect for that $400,000. And the way we deal with that ambiguity is by having an agreement with the customer is, I am going to check back in with you repeatedly to show you what value you're getting, to show you what your money's getting you, to revisit what your original plan was against what your goal is for value, and help you make a decision about whether this project makes sense to keep going forward or all. Because with software development, one of the things that we always have to acknowledge for a lot of projects is at the very beginning of the project, even after that initial analysis where we've set our budget, there's often no guarantee. And we need to communicate that honestly with our customer and work with them as they go along. Because what could very well happen is the business makes a decision that we have an opportunity to gain some value. We're willing to spend this much money on getting that value. The development team may start working on that, and they find that with the staff that they have, with the ability that they have, they're not able to deliver enough of the scope within the budget for the company to recognize that value. And you need to acknowledge that to your customer as soon as possible so they can make a decision, does this make sense to go forward? One of the things that we have to realize with software projects is sometimes once we start learning more about the problem is that it is no longer feasible. And we need to be honest with our customer so they can decide that, oh, wait, I can't realize the value that I was expecting. We need to wrap this project up. And when that happens, I always like to go back to my customers, and because I was good and didn't promise them stuff at the beginning, to remind them of that continuously, that there may get to be a point where we're not able to deliver the value that we need, so let's cut our losses. And that's not necessarily a failure. It's not as if we had done more planning at the beginning, we somehow would have discovered that earlier. A lot of discovery doesn't happen until you actually start going forward. So the key to making that ability to adapt as you go along and to make those trade-offs is to have really good communication right from the very beginning with your customer and say, look, we're going to make trade-offs as we go along. I'm going to be showing you what I'm going to be delivering as we go along, and we're going to constantly evaluating the value delivered versus the budget you spend. And that might potentially mean that we walk away from this investment, but that's better than spending all of your $400,000 budget on your new house and find out that it's not livable. Would you rather do that, or would you rather spend $50,000 on a house and then find out that it's not livable, and then now you can go and reinvest that $350,000 on something that will provide you some value?
I just want to add one extra point. Sorry for interrupting, but the one thing that I also want to be very cautious of is that you need to know who your customer is and their different roles. I've lived through this many, many times where people have added things to our backlog and wanted things and desperately needed them. But guess what? They didn't actually have the power to do so. They weren't, they didn't want, I needed to have my sunroom and my tile floor. Sorry, I'm the user. I need to have it. But they don't have budget approval processes. And one of the things that I've learned to realize is that, customer requests, or your request limits, as Phil put them, are exactly what they are, and you must deeply understand the community of customer, of what customer really is, who actually gets to make decisions around increases in time and in budget and in scope. Who are we getting feedback from? It's nice, in a perfect little world, if we have a nice, simple little project and I get to work with, my user every single day, and we go for coffee and we talk about their usage. But I've worked on projects where there's 100 developers where, we have customers that are spread out across 50, 60 people. And those decisions are much harder. Prioritization, change control, do need to, even on an agile project, become first-class citizens. Just as an aside, one of the things that I've learned over my career is that some of that ceremony is needed, and I've actually looked to a methodology called PRINCE2 to help with an organization of kind of those types of problems, those oversight problems when it comes to budget, scope, and change control in general. Just because we've added it to the backlog and just because it has high priority doesn't necessarily mean that we do it in many large organizations. So PRINCE2 actually gives you a little bit of ceremony, and it still allows you to be adaptable and agile and iterative with giving you a little bit more ceremony with regards to how those decisions are made. I actually have noticed. I've noticed that there's actually possibly a question missing. I've implemented Agile and I'm failing. I want to, maybe while people are actually talking or doing this poll, I want to point out that just because you're doing Agile does not mean you're going to succeed. In fact, I have seen as many failed Agile projects as I have seen failed waterfall projects. One of the things that you will realize with the adoption of Agile is that you should, though, realize your failures sooner than later. Agile is not the silver bullet and does not guarantee success. So if your reason to adopt Agile is to have greater project success, you may be fooling yourself.
And that's interesting, Joel. You talk about failure as if it's a really horrible bad thing, but failure is a part of learning. If you're not willing to fail at something, then you're probably not going to learn. You're not going to end up doing anything new. The classic for me is, you know, everybody here, at least if you're in a North American audience or maybe European, there's a product called WD-40 that people use. And the 40 is because it was the 40th try at making the product. They had 39 failures before that. So failure isn't necessarily a bad thing as long as, A, you learn from it, and, B, you make the failure as small as possible. And Agile is really great at that. So if you're going to fail, fail fast. And that is a really important piece.
We all know how important collaboration is for your projects. And if you want to bring the communication among all your team members to the next level, emails just won't help. Telerik's project management tool, TeamPulse, now offers the activity stream as a way for team members to always stay informed about what is happening on their projects and start in-context discussions. Join the conversation now at telerik.com/TeamPulse. Without Telerik's TeamPulse as a sponsor, this podcast would not be possible.
I do want to address a couple of the myths that we talk about in the book just for the wider audience. And those, you know, the first three, don't follow a plan, don't have architecture, don't provide documentation, those things. I think we covered the plan a bit, but I want to talk about architecture and documentation and those types of things. And the concept we talk a lot about with Agile is the concept of the last responsible moment. And that's very different than the last possible moment. The last possible moment is when my 11-year-old fifth grader does his homework. It's usually the night before it's due. It's bedtime. And he says to my wife, Mom, I have this project due tomorrow that I didn't start on. And then they spend a good portion of the night working on it. That's not how we want to do software development. That ends up leading into death marches and things like that. What we want to do is do things at the last responsible moment. So let's talk about documentation. What documentation do you need to have before the project starts? Well, that depends on your organization. I've been in organizations where they had to have a fair amount of documentation up front just to get funding. Well, guess what? You have to do it then, right? Healthcare, they're more worried about making sure the documentation is accurate. And a lot of times in the healthcare projects I did, we would do the documentation after the code was written, right? Because then we could guarantee that the documentation matched the project. So you got to look at things and don't do everything just up front because somebody says to do it up front. Do it when it makes the most sense. The longer you wait, the more information you'll have, the more accurate it'll be. But again, it doesn't mean don't do the documentation or wait to the very last possible moment. The day you do the release, oh my gosh, we have to have help documentation out there. Let's throw something together. So that's not what we're trying to say at all.
If Agile isn't the latest hype, why are projects still developer-oriented and lack the bridge between disciplined teams?
So I would like to take that one. You're absolutely right. In my experience with Agile adoption, I usually see it very developer oriented. It's really been all about the developer. You know, let's make the developers' lives a little bit better. And these are some of the reasons why we produced the book on the e-myths, that Agile was only about the developers. And I think one of the reasons that myth came about is because to this day, the adoption of Agile seems to be a developer-led kind of process. We see testing trail behind. We see development managers trail behind. When I talk to development managers and CIOs, I get a common feedback is like, Agile is something the developers do, and that's a very interesting metaphor because if you look at the reasons that Agile succeeds, it's because everybody's doing Agile. Now, this is why one of the things that I've done over the past 7 years is actually try to go up the chain a little bit and start talking about what is the bridge that brings together the Agile world with the world of business. And quite frankly, I'll be honest with you, that bridge is lean. or what we call lean development. Now, lean development, in my opinion and the opinion of others, is why Agile works. But I can actually use that terminology and speak to development managers and not talk about Agile at all. And in fact, in many ways, lean is a way of adopting Agile processes incrementally. So when I work with organizations and I talk especially to dev managers at CIO levels, we're talking about increasing value, understanding where the waste is in our environment, removing waste, and you're using those languages, and that's just, you know, that has a lot of resonance to those people. Now, how do we represent value? How do we represent waste? How do we remove that? And it turns out that we pull in Agile practices at all levels to help identify value, represent value, and in fact remove waste. And Agile is a way of achieving some of these lean practices. So there's a book that you might want to read. It's called SDLC 3.0. It really talks about the emergence of lean and aspects of lean, like Kanban, into the world of Agile and how that's impacting both the business, the customer, as well as the development and testing environments. We do need to bridge that gap, and Agile alone may not be the language that is going to allow us to get there. Agile can't just be a developer-oriented framework, and what I'm finding in my world is that bridging that gap is really over the bridge called lean, and something that you should maybe look into, because it does help make sure that we can address all forms from business to consumers.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that a little bit. Many of the projects that I've been on that were struggling with Agile were ones where the developers had really embraced that. They had maybe lived through some tough projects where you know, they could see what was going wrong and they didn't have any influence, so they wanted to take some of that influence back. But they forgot about everybody else, that they really did focus more on their own part of the development process and take some control of that, which is good. But they didn't understand or didn't realize or didn't appreciate all the different pieces that go in with that. Or they possibly weren't empowered to work with the other areas. Often in a very siloed organization, each one of those silos is a little protective of their the people that they control, and they don't want the people who work in those silos to be too autonomous. So there is still some of that command and control culture. For Agile to be effective, all of the different disciplines really need to work together, and that's one of the things we talk about, that cross-functional, self-managing teams, and I think too many people have thought that was just talking about, a group of self-managing developers. I was just in a very interesting email thread with other Agile practitioners over at scrum.org. We have a mailing list where all the Scrum team trainers talk about items, and one of the changes in some of the Scrum guidance right now is to talk about the development team. So you've got the Scrum team, which is the product owner, of the development team, and the Scrum Master, and the term development team is really throwing some people off, because you have many different people who are responsible for developing software who don't consider themselves a developer. So that little bit of language has definitely led people more in the direction of thinking that, well, look at Scrum. Scrum only talks about the development team. They're not talking about the testers. They're not talking about business analysts. They're not talking about the installation specialists. They're not talking about sales. They're not about marketing. All of those different pieces. And it's unfortunate that's the way that's been taken, because certainly from where I sit, the more people you can bring into your tent, the more people you can get involved in developing software. Whether that be, and developing software often is needs input from the sales and marketing staff. It needs input from QA. It needs those people as part of the development team. So if people are looking at Agile as being something that's just for developers, then you are definitely going to be less successful.
Yeah, so Matthew has one. My company feels strongly that after an initial development of a product or modification, that the entire product be transitioned to a lights-on support team. I feel this contributes to a siloed culture. Should the original development team continue working with support after implementation? Well, I hear a couple of assumptions in the question that you're asking. And one of them seems like the assumption is that you do one release and then you're done. And you're not going to build on that release. And that sounds very waterfall-y traditional to me. So there's a couple issues there. I always recommend that you release early and often. The best way to get feedback on your product is to throw something out there. And you know, a term that we like to use these days is MMF, or minimal marketable functionality, or you know, whatever letters you want to choose there. But what can we put out there that's going to provide value to the user? And be complete enough to provide value, but not totally chromed up, right? Because you don't want to gold plate it if it turns out that you missed and people don't really need that, or you didn't understand the requirement correctly. So I think first and foremost, if you're just doing one big bang type release, that's kind of your initial problem that you might want to resolve, because just throwing it out there and walking away tends to backfire a lot of times. Now, I'm not saying that your company is not successful at doing that. You might very well be. People have been writing software for a lot longer than, you know, the term agile was even out there. So, you know, there are people who are successful. We just think that, you know, by doing the more agile approach, you can be more successful and eliminate more waste and be happier. that being said, having some people who originally wrote it stay on and do support, I think is great. Because you've got that knowledge. A better way would be to transition that knowledge to others through things like pair programming and those types of factors. If you've got a bus factor of one, and that's the number of people who can be hit by the proverbial bus and, you know, totally sabotage your project, and if your bus factor is one, then it's doomed to fail, because people get hit by bus every day. And what I mean by that, in IT we usually talk about the bus being the IT shop across the street who's got better benefits or better foosball tables. So you want to make sure that you spread that knowledge and do things like pair programming and other transparent types, so you get that level of knowledge up.
So I'm going to look at it from two perspectives. First perspective is from the Team Pulse team, as an example. We're a product team, and we don't understand the concept of having something in maintenance. We're, you know, all of our developers work our support channels, period. They have to understand the customer's voice, because we have a continuous product, a continuous life cycle. Now, we're a product. We know that that's different than what most of the, you know, projects are like in the real world. Steve and I were actually part of many very, very large projects. We worked together in a past life as well, where, you know, we worked on big insurance projects where, you know, at the end of the project, it was transitioned into, you know, we were done. Version one is done, and we're not 100% sure if there is a version two, we don't know what that looks like, but there needs to be a support mechanism, a transition to production, and an ongoing production level support that happened there. It's been my experience, though, that support rarely just means bug fixes, that it sometimes also means added features, and that the line between a bug and a missing feature is somewhat blurry. And it's been my experience that in order for us to be proficient at both bug fixing and for the addressing of small features as we have it in a production support environment, we need to have knowledge. And the only knowledge that we can gain is that from the product team. So I've never seen a successful, you know, handover into production that didn't involve a large amount of effort from the original development team. The most successful transitions I've seen, and I've seen probably a good dozen very, very big projects move into a production support environment, is when a good portion of the original developers are transitioned onto that support team for a period of time, and then work, as Phil suggested, in a pair programming fashion as they onboard new people. So as an example, one of the things that we like to do in big production support environments is that when we're onboarding new people, We get them to help write the unit tests that expose the bugs that we're finding. This allows them to experiment with the architecture and the implementation without actually destroying things, right? So prove that the bug is happening and write a unit test that shows that, that it's turning red and then allows us to fix, you know, fix those bugs incrementally and turn those tests to green as we deploy it out. This allows a lot of skill transference to be done. Now, obviously, the more complex and large the system, the more of the transition needs to happen. I have seen organizations that have this, you know, magical production support team that, you know, are production support across many different organizations and expect to be trained in how to do that, and you end up making all this training classes. Those just don't work. You end up having to have, you know, second and tertiary level supports that include the original development team and knowledge in order to help you go through that. Now, Steve, you've lived through that a few times.
Absolutely. I actually spent a good chunk of my life, but there was nothing good about it, doing support on a product that was handed off to me, that I wasn't part of the original development team, that I was said, here, Steve, you're a smart guy. You're going to be part of the development team that's going to support this. And it was, they probably used the term team loosely there because it was me. And honestly, that support effort was an abysmal failure. The product development kind of ground to a halt because there wasn't really good knowledge transfer. And in that particular case, I don't think there was a good argument to not keep the original development team together, because there's probably enough work to keep the original development team get better on support. And I use sort of the rabbit ear quote on support, because that was a living, breathing project and product that could have kept people busy. But the company, you know, wanted to optimize their people by shifting them around. And shifting around individuals seldom leads to optimization. I think the best optimization you're going to have is by keeping groups of people together and allow them to work together on items. If they can stay working on the same product as a group and they can shift loads and share share that knowledge is probably the best. If there isn't enough work for that team to stay together on a product, I always recommend that same team go and work someplace else, go and work on some other product inside that thing, and then cycle back to the original project. So keeping that team together is really important. That hopefully helps deal with the silo issue, in that it's not a separate group that's responsible for this work. It's the same group, but they may just interleave that work with work on other areas.
And that's today's show. Thanks for listening. If you have any comments, suggestions, or ideas for new shows, you can reach out to us at telerik.com/zerotoagile, telerik.com/zerotoagile. Reach out to us on Twitter at @zerotoagile. Or email us at zerotoagile@telerik.com. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you next time on Zero to Agile. Have a great day.